This podcast is brought to you by Tobin Brothers Funerals, celebrating lives.
Hello, folks. This is Tommy Emmanuel. You're listening to Gavin Wood's podcast, you lucky people.
Australian guitarist, session player, and recording artist. You could say the guitarist's guitarist. Top of his game in the world, a member of the Order of Australia, and one of the 10 best guitarists in the world. Welcome to the podcast, Tommy Emmanuel. G'day, Tommy.
Hello, Gavin.
Tommy, how are you? It's great to have you on the podcast.
Well, thank you for asking me. I've been living here in America for the last 20 years. I come back home to Australia as often as I can. And my last tour was there in May of this year. And it was the biggest tour of my life. It was so beautiful. I'm a boy living his dream. You know,
in Nashville, when you look at all your YouTube videos, I notice now Mason Williams' Classical Gas, your version of that song has hit 25 million views.
Yeah, it's pretty amazing. And you know, the story of that video is I had a show in the town of Bielefeld in Germany, and a dear friend of mine has a studio in his house about 40 miles away from Bielefeld. And I rented his studio for an hour, and we set up a couple of cameras and some microphones. And I came in and shot 6 songs, finished and mixed in an hour. Each one was one take, done. And they're the videos that got the millions of views. And people think that, you know, I spent my life coming up with that arrangement. And the funny thing is, I only ever played Classical Gas like that once. And that's the video that people look at. I don't play it like that on stage. I play it differently all the time.
Well, congratulations to you, because that is just one incredible clip. How you play guitar and do what you did on Classical Gas, it's like another universe. You're amazing.
Well, it's a work in progress, as you know. I just consider myself about the luckiest guy on the planet, because I get to have a wonderful life doing what I love. And I found out when I was a kid out in the bush that when I played, something happened to people, and I don't know what it is. It's not me, but it's something that happens when I play.
Now, Tommy, speaking of the bush, let's go right back to a very young Tommy Emmanuel, like a really young Tommy Emmanuel. Where were you born?
I was born in Muswellbrook up in the Hunter Valley. My dad was working in the open cut coal mine up there at that time. And so I was born in 55, and we were there a couple of years, and then we moved to Gunnedah, Tamworth, and that's where we all started playing music, you know. For my 4th birthday, I got a little guitar, and my mum showed me how to play chords and all that stuff. And then my dad bought Phil, my brother, and I, he bought us electric guitars, and we started playing straight away, you know.
So you went on the road.
The first couple of years of our playing life, we just played for our neighbors, and we entered in, you know, Hoadley's Battle of the Sounds and stuff like that. And then we won through a competition, through a radio station, we won an appearance on a show. I think it might have been 6 o'clock rock or some name like that. And it was out of Brisbane. And we went on that show and played live with a live audience. And it was our first time on television. And there happened to be a television producer from Los Angeles visiting Australia, advising Australian television people about technology and stuff like that. And he saw us play and went straight up to my dad and said, these kids need to be seen and heard by the public. You need to get them in front of an audience, you know. So that became our mission then, was to get out in front of the public and to try and get ourselves, you know, on the radio and on TV and all that sort of stuff. My dad was a mechanic. He was a real tinkerer and a thinker, you know. And he could fix the vacuum cleaner. He could fix your car. He could fix your watch. He could. He knew so much about life and was a fascinating person. We had an E.K. Holden station wagon with a trailer, and we had all the gear on the roof. And Phil and I and our two sisters would sleep in the car, and Mum and Dad would sleep in a little makeshift tent kind of thing. And, you know, that's how we travelled around Australia.
Now, you travelled around so much, didn't the education department come to you and say, hey, you've got to pick a town, you've got to go to school?
Yeah, well, they gave us a hard time wherever we were because they assumed that we weren't getting an education. And we were. We were doing schoolwork through Blackfriars Correspondence School. And so we would get our week's work in the mail. You know, it would come to a post office in a town where we were, and there, you know, and we were actually getting a good education, not just scholastic education, but real life education. We were visiting places like Alice Springs and Darwin, and going out to Ayers Rock and the Devil's Marbles, and seeing iconic things that were a part of the history of Australia, and where the Flying Doctor came from, and all that sort of stuff, you know, witnessing great change in our country. I think that it was a great education, but eventually we got forced off the road and we settled in the town of Parkes, where the radio telescope is. That's where we went to school.
Yeah, so tell me the family dynamic. How many siblings have you got?
Well, there were six of us. Phil is gone and my eldest sister, Virginia, is gone. So there are four of us left.
Now, did the other siblings join in with you on stage? Was it a complete family thing?
Well, Chris was the drummer. He's the eldest. He's up in Ingham in North Queensland. And my sister, Virginia, who passed away in 18, she played the lap steel guitar and sang a little bit. And then my little sister, Veronica, she took up playing guitar as well and sang. She'd sing stuff like, I'm gonna knock on your door, ring on your bell, and all that sort of stuff, you know?
Yeah. Oh, cool. That mate, that's a show. You've got a whole show in one family. That's brilliant.
Yeah, but, you know, I was the only one who really wanted to travel and to have a career in music. Everybody else weren't that interested and went off and had kids and all that sort of stuff. Because our dad died when I was 10, and he had a massive heart attack and fell down dead. And he was just gone like that. Yeah. And so, you know, we had to carry on. And my eldest brothers, Phil and Chris and myself, because we were the breadwinners, you know, we had to get out there and work and try and bring in an income that we could rent a house and all that while we were going to school. So we achieved that. And it was good experience for us and taught us a lot about, you know, the benefits of sticking at hard work and being reliable and all those things.
Tobin Brothers believe every life is unique. Every funeral should be too. Visit turbanbrothers.com.au.
Hello, folks. This is Tommy Emmanuel. You're listening to Gavin Wood's podcast. You lucky people.
Phil was, a pretty handy guitarist as well. Was there sibling rivalry between the two of you?
Not really, but we kind of made the joke of it and played it up a little on stage. I'd play something and Phil would say, yeah, he stole that from me a couple of days ago and stuff like that, you know. Actually, I can tell you that because I'm the younger brother, Phil had a really fabulous ear, and he could hear something and say, okay, it's C minor to A flat, blah, blah, blah. And he could tell you what the chords were just listening to it. He taught me how to do the same thing. And everything he learned, we'd hear a record by somebody and he'd work the thing out And then he'd say, hey, idiot, get over here. And I'd go over to his place and he would show me how the song went and then show me how the chords went. And then I would be the accompanist and he would play the tune. And that's kind of how we developed as a duo, you know.
Anyone that can play by ear, I mean, that is a gift.
Yeah, well, you put sheet music in front of us and we got pretty quiet. I'm still the same, you know. I can read a chord chart and I love all that. And I did, you know, 30 years of playing on everything from Coca-Cola commercials to Carols by Candlelight. And I put myself through all that to gain the experience of where I had to learn to read charts. But I still don't read the actual notes. People say to me, when you're soloing, what theory are you thinking? And I'm like, none whatsoever. I'm playing purely from instinct and purely from a sound that's in my head and an idea that I've got right now.
You're also playing from your heart.
Totally. And it's totally from deep inside, you know.
The first time I saw Tommy Emmanuel was with one of the greatest bands. I love this band, the Southern Star Band, and I love the lead singer, Doug Parkinson. What a voice. What a band.
What a band.
Hey?
Yeah, what a great band. Mark Kennedy on drums and Duncan McGuire on bass. Frank Ezra Smith, rest his soul, on keyboards. And me, the young boy from the country who knew nothing about that kind of soul music. And oh boy, did I have to learn quickly because I wanted to be in that band.
Yeah,
you know?
Well, that was the hottest band going around. Musically, everybody just adored that band. Now, there is a clip of Doug Parkinson and the Southern Star Band. I think it's 2SM's Concert of the Century on the steps of the Opera House with about 200,000 people.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, what a clip that is. Tell me about it.
Yeah. Oh, I remember that day so well. It was incredible to be up there. And Doug was pacing up and down, so nervous. And I said, come on, DP, you know, you get out there. They're going to love you, you know. And, you know, we just all looked kind of gawky to me when I see it now. But I can hear the joy in the music that we were playing. You know, I would play that intro to I'll Be Around and the audience would just go nuts and love it, you know. And I'd never experienced that before, you know. It was amazing. I would have loved to have had another go at it, you know, down the track when I got a bit more experience.
So from the Southern Star Band, which is probably the premier band in the country, you then went on to play with Dragon. You did the 87 tour with Tina Turner, played with John Farnham. All of a sudden, you were right up there and you were surfing that wave.
I was, yeah, and I'm still on the wave, and the wave kind of comes and goes. And that's a good description of the music business, is that it comes in waves. And the great thing is, you know, like Ricky Skaggs here said to me one day, he said, you know, I'm just standing still playing my music, playing bluegrass music. And look what's happening. Twice now it's come back around and been the biggest thing around, you know. And so he said, I don't go chasing stuff. I just stand still and let it come through to me. And it's a very interesting way of seeing it.
We've got to talk about one of the greatest guitarists in the world, Chet Atkins. As a young boy, you wrote him a letter. How old were you?
I did. I was 11. My dad had just passed away. I was living inside his music. It was my comfort place, you know. I decided to write him a fan letter. And my mother encouraged me to do that. And I put on the envelope, Chet Atkins, Nashville, America. And he got it. Yeah, it's true.
Fantastic.
Yeah. And about 3 months later, I came home from school in Parks. Came home from school and my mum said, put your bag down and go in your room. There's something on your bed. And there was this big brown envelope. And in that envelope was a letter from Chet and a black and white photograph signed to me. And, you know, this is 1967. he would have been the busiest guy in this town in those days. He was producing Don Gibson, Skeeter Davis, Willie Nelson, Jim Reeves, Dolly Parton. You know, I mean, everybody. He was doing everyone. And he had so many artists that he had signed to the label. Plus, he was doing his own records. I don't know how he did it. He said to me many times, when I look at my body of work, I just can't believe it. I don't understand how I did all that. I don't remember half of it. I remember years later, I was about 20, I think, and I get this note in the mail, and it's a handwritten letter from Chet, and somebody had sent him tapes of me playing without telling me, and he listened to them, and he wrote me this note, and it said, if you ever come to Nashville, here's my number. Please call me. A few years later, 1980, I made the pilgrimage here to Nashville, and I went to his office. I called him first, and he said, yep, come on down, I'll see you. I went down to his office on Music Row, and he came down the stairs carrying one of his guitars and came up to me, and he looked just like he did on his record covers, you know. And there was my hero, you know, and I nearly turned to water, you know. And he said to me, come in here, I want to hear you play. So he took me in a side office, and I sat down, and I went straight into me and Bobby McGee, and I'm playing the tune, and he just joined in like he knew exactly what the song needed, and he played. He made me sound so good, what he was doing. It was so beautiful. And then he asked me to play another tune. I played another tune, and he just kind of watched. And then he said, hey, play that part again. And I played it again. And he said, I didn't do that. I didn't. And he started pointing things out that he knew he didn't do. And it was his way of telling me I was doing my own thing, you know, because I was so influenced by him. And let me say, Gavin, a lot of young people are so afraid to play in front of you because they play your, I'm talking about myself, they play my songs. They're learning the guitar and they're inspired by what I do. And I can't wait to tell them, it's okay. I started out like everybody else, emulating someone else who I loved what they did. And I wanted to play like them. I wanted to be like them. But eventually, I grew out of that and I grew into who I'm supposed to be. My playing evolved and I found my voice and my style. So don't be worried about playing someone else's tunes like them. You know, it's a great place to start. And I believe it's nature's way that we all start out that way. And then eventually, in time, with enough experience and enough hard work, we find the way that we're supposed to play.
For you to have the Chet Atkins connection, that was just an unbelievable gift, but you've also got to have the talent to back it up.
Well, that does help. You know, I came here a long time ago, and because I hooked up with Chet, he hooked me up with so many other players and so many other people. It's been great being an instrumentalist because there are so many artists who are singers and songwriters who come here to Music City and end up working in the local grocery store because it's so hard for a singer-songwriter because there's just too many of them. I came here to America to the Chet Atkins convention and I played and I got an unbelievable response. And people, you know, people, they didn't just applaud. People went wild. People went crazy. And the funny thing is, Chet knew they would. And then I got invited to play with him on some shows, and he brought me out, and I played a couple of songs, and the crowd went wild, you know. So then I started getting booked by people who were connected to Chet, and I started to build a bit of a following. But then trying to find an agent who wanted to work with a relatively unknown instrumentalist is like a needle in the haystack. I would put on a show here in Nashville, and we would invite agents and managers and blah, 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 and all that. And eventually the right guy came along. And how it happened was Chet, he's the guy who used to book Chet. And he came backstage and Chet said to him, "You two should work together." And he just looked at me straight away and he said, "You show me what you can do and I'll tell you if I'm interested." You know, there was no, there's no easy way, you know. And so I had to prove to him that I could draw a crowd. I had to build it by hand, you know, and I still do that.
Keith Urban took like 14 years around the periphery before he hit, you know, any sort of success.
Exactly. And I knew Keith back then, and he would come out to Chet's house and pick me up so we could go hang out and talk guitars and all that sort of stuff. I had a conversation with Keith when he was 16 on a plane trip from Brisbane to Sydney. And he said, I don't know what to do, sort of thing. I said to him, where do you see yourself? What's your vision for where you belong? And he said, I want to be a stadium player. I said, well, you better get the hell out of here and get some hit records, because if you want to fill a stadium, you got to have some big records behind you.
Oh, good advice. Good advice.
Well, it's true, you know. We had that conversation. And a lot of times when I was playing here in town, he would come in with his little amp and guitar, and we would play stuff together, and nobody knew him. He just hung in there. He found some good, he got some good songs. He got some good people, and he just kept going. And look at him now, you know. He's unbelievable.
Any song can be played at a funeral. What would you like? Visit tobinbrothers.com.au.
Hello, folks. This is Tommy Emmanuel. You're listening to Gavin Wood's podcast. You lucky people.
Now, Tommy, in 1999, Chet Atkins said you were a fearless finger-picking guitar player, and that's when you were awarded the Certified Guitar Player Award.
Yeah.
It's a great key ring, which is on your store, the Tommy Emmanuel merchandise store. It looks good, brother.
Well, Chet gave that award to Jerry Reed, to Steve Wariner, to John Knowles, and myself. On my award, it says, for lifetime contribution to the art of fingerpicking. It's just beautiful to have that kind of affirmation from a guy that you looked up to. He showed so many of us the way, you know. He created a level of integrity and quality in his productions, in his playing, just everything, you know.
And in the year 2000, Tommy, you and your brother Phil closed the Sydney Olympics with nearly 3 billion viewers. Did somebody tell you before you went on that probably 3 billion viewers will be watching you?
A beautiful story about that, Gavin, is I had no money at that time, and I was, you know, struggling to make a living, living in England and coming to America to do short trips, to play, to earn enough money to keep going. And I had two little girls and a wife in England, and I was really struggling. But when I knew that we were going to be doing the Olympic Games thing, I wanted to wear something that would stand out. So my friend Gina took me down to Manuel's shop here in Nashville. It's where all the big stars get their clothes. Anyway, I saw this beautiful coat, and it was sparkly. It was a very light blue color, and it was really sparkly and kind of flashy. And I thought, I want to wear something like that that really stands out, because I'm going to have a white Maton guitar with a red scratch guard with my name written on the neck. The world is going to know who it is. And so Manuel himself comes out and says, hello, young man, and do you like that coat? And I said, I love that coat. And he said, try it on. I tried it on, and I saw the tag. It was $10,000.
Ah!
And and then he said, what do you do? And I said, I'm a musician, blah, blah, blah. Oh, how wonderful. And I said, look, I'm flying to Australia to play in the Olympic Games closing ceremony. Oh, my God, are you? I said, yeah, and I'm going to be on TV all over the world, blah, blah, blah. He said, well, you better have a nice shirt to wear with that jacket. So he picked the shirt out and put it in a zip bag. He said, bring it back when you're done. And he just loaned it to me.
Oh, what a sweet man.
Yeah, he was a great, great, great person. So I wore that coat and the shirt, and then I brought them all the way back when I came here.
Let's get to 2010. You became a member of the Order of Australia. You got the AM. Must have been very proud for you and the family.
Oh, it was a beautiful experience. And Kim Beazley was such a gentleman and conducted the ceremony and the whole thing. And there were four-star generals present. The head of all the military were there. And it was a beautiful event. It was in Washington, D.C., at the Australian Embassy. It was beautiful.
Well, congratulations on that. That's well deserved.
Oh, thank you. I appreciate it. It says for services to music and services to all the hundreds of charities that I've been involved with over the years, it's been so good. Now I'm involved with several charities here that are spreading around the world, like Guitars for Vets. We raise money and buy guitars in bulk. And there are guitar teachers who give a guitar and a lesson free every week to a man or a woman who's served the country and who's now a military vet and needs to get something good going in their lives, you know.
Well, how good is that, Tommy? That's great therapy to learn guitar. I mean, that's brilliant.
I've been their ambassador out here now and you know, I've kind of got, I've blackmailed most of the big guitar companies and getting product from them at a good price so that we can hand them on.
I know your faith keeps you going. Does it keep you centered?
I'm definitely a believer in a higher power. I believe that I know when I'm doing the work I'm supposed to be doing, because things just keep happening that are way out of my league. So all I can say is, I've never had it so good. My life is simple. It's wonderful. I'm 68 and I'm so grateful for my health and my family and everything.
Let's get to your ambassadorship. You are the greatest commercial for Maiten Guitars. You are so loyal. You've been there from the get-go. You are the poster child.
Well, until someone gives me something better, that's what I play. Of course I'm loyal. I'm an Australian and people say, don't you miss home? And I'm like, how can I open my case? And there it is. I do play other guitars. You know, I play the right guitar for the right song when I'm recording. But when I play live, nothing sounds as good as my Maitens. I haven't played any other guitar that came anywhere near close. I'm just so proud of them. My first Maiten, as you're probably aware, was our electric ones that we got in 1961. So it was a long time ago. But then during the 70s, when Phil and I kind of became a powerhouse duo, the only guitar that prior to that I'd used Ovation guitars with Slim Dusty and Buddy Williams, people like that, because we wanted to plug in. And Ovation guitars, because of Glenn Campbell, really were the only ones that had a half-decent sound, you know. And so I played Ovation for a while. I used my Ovations on, you can hear it on Air Supplies, I'm All Out of Love, Lost in Love, Every Woman in the World, all those songs. That's me playing the rhythm guitar parts and some lead parts as well. And on I'm All Out of Love, that's me playing bass as well. That was a long time ago. Then the Japanese came out with a Takamine that had a better pickup than the Ovation. And so I got a Takamine and I plugged it into this Bose PA that Phil and I used to use. And it just sounded so much better. And so I was off and running with this guitar and I could get it loud as hell, you know, and it just wouldn't feed back and give me trouble. Anyway, the Maiten people came to me in Melbourne and they were ready to walk away. There were only four people running the company, there are now something like 85, and it's a magnificent success story. But there, in those days, and they said to me, you're the only acoustic guitar player out there with any profile, and you're playing a Japanese guitar. Why aren't you playing our guitars? And I said, I prefer Maiden guitars, but you don't have a guitar that has a pickup I can use. And everybody plugs in and plays loud, you know. And they said, well, tell us what you need. So that's kind of where it started. And they just got behind it and worked their butt off and started bringing me prototypes and stuff during the 80s when I was in Dragon. I had a couple of Maidens they'd bring to me, and I'd plug them in. And I'd say, the bass isn't right. It sounds too fake. Or, I need a mid-range that sounds more like this. And, you know, and then away it went. And then eventually they really got it good. And I got my first little 808 model, which was my first Maiden with my signature on it. And, oh, man, it was beautiful. And that guitar is in the Guitar Museum in Tamworth.
Oh, okay. Excellent.
Along with my old Telecaster that I used to play with Farnham and Doug Parkinson and that. Yeah, that guitar's in there as well. And they're going to stuff me and mount me in there one day.
So. Oh, look, we'll all come and see you.
Thanks, mate.
Now, sad news, of course, 2018, Phil passed away, sadly. And in that same year...
Yeah.
He was awarded the OAM. Now, I'm curious, did Phil get his OAM before he died?
No, it was after.
Oh, that's sad.
Yeah.
Oh, man.
But, you know, there were some wonderful things said about him that day. And, you know, he was such a kind and loving man. And a lot of people, when they come to my shows in Australia, people come up and talk to me about him, you know, that he did this for me. He told my son this and it changed his life and, you know, stuff like that. Yeah.
Well, let's get to some of these awards, of which you have many, sir. 1992, the ARIE Award. 1994, ARIE Award for the Best Contemporary Award for Determination and the Journey. And then 2011, you were inducted into the Australian Roll of Renown, which Phil was inducted into as well.
Yep, that's right.
And then way back, the Mo Awards, 1994 and 1996, the Australian Performer of the Year. Then we get to 2005, Instrumental of the Year for The Fiddler. 2007, Instrumental of the Year for Game Show and Cannonball Rag. 2019, Instrumental of the Year, Wheelin' and Dealin'. And 2021, Bluegrass Recording of the Year, The Finger Pickin' Good with Kirsty Cox featuring you. And you won all those awards. And you've been nominated for 2 Grammy Awards. You are unbelievable. What a star.
Well, I'm just getting started, I think.
They'll have a star on the Hollywood Walk of Fame very soon. And I mentioned before, Classical Gas, of course, the video on YouTube, 25 million views, and How Deep Is Your Love, the Bee Gees, 10 million. Now, Accomplice 2, tell me about the new album.
This album has Billy Strings, Molly Tuttle, Sierra Hull, Michael McDonald, Jerry Douglas, David Grisman, Little Feet, Nitty Gritty Dirt Band. It has some amazing people on there, and Raoul Mallow, the lead singer from the Mavericks. We do a Sam Cooke song together. There's a lot of beautiful stuff on there. There's some vocal songs and there's some instrumentals. And there's a comedy song that Sam Bush and I do, which is a spoof that Homer and Jethro did back in the 50s. The Yellow Rose of Texas, the cutest on this earth. Her right eye looks at Dallas, her left one at Fort Worth. And so forth, you know.
That's fantastic. Now, can we talk about the doco that's in production right now, your documentary, The Endless Road?
Well, it's as good as finished. We were just waiting for clearance on some of the music, and people are really asleep at the wheel sometimes. But it's all done, and we're going to get it out as soon as we can.
Something to look forward to. Now, if you go on to TommyEmmanuel.com store, you'll see all your albums there, of which there's over 20 albums you've recorded. Is that correct?
Absolutely, yeah.
Such a great body of work, man.
Well, thank you. It's just I've got a lot of different stuff going on. I recorded a live album at the Opera House there in Sydney in May. We did two shows in one day. We did a 3 o'clock and an 8 o'clock show in that incredible, iconic hall. We filmed and recorded both shows. So there's going to be a live at the Opera House album and DVD, I guess, or film come out about that.
We'll probably see that on PBS in America as well, because you've done that before.
There's a PBS special running at the moment, which I shot here in Nashville last December. It has Emmylou Harris and Rodney Crowell, Sierra Hull, and really, PBS did a great job. It's with a live audience. There's no, like, cuts and things. It's the show as it went down. It's beautifully done.
Now, listen, I'm going to ask you, if you've got time, a few questions without notice.
Yes, sir.
You're a good man. We know who inspired you to make music. If you could open up a show for any artist, who would it be?
That's a tough question. I'd have to say Keith.
Well, yes. He can give you a leg up now.
Absolutely.
Mate, if you could change anything about the music industry, what would you do?
I can't change anything, and I can't change people. I can change me. That's all I can do. I can be in a place of acceptance that this is how things are, and I better damn well get smart and try and find my way. I don't have to work harder. I got to work smarter. There's a lot about this business that is not healthy for the younger generation, and I want to tell people that views on YouTube and Instagram and Facebook and all that do not equal concert tickets sold. You have to create something that makes people want to run out and buy a ticket. You have to do that. You can't sit at home playing your guitar in your bedroom and make a video and spend, you know, ages making it look great and all that, and then expect, I'll now go out and be a concert player. I'm sorry, but it doesn't work like that.
Yeah. Okay, final question, Tommy Emmanuel.
Yes, sir.
What's the best show that you've ever done?
Hopefully it'll be this Saturday night coming in Chicago.
Good answer. Good answer. Fantastic. What a way to wrap up this marvellous podcast. Tommy Emmanuel, you are a star.
Thank you, Gav.
You are a dear friend, and I love chatting to you. All the very best. We wish you every success.
I appreciate that, and same to you, young man. Keep doing what you're doing. Apparently it's working.
Thanks, Tommy. All the best, bud. See you, buddy.
Great talking with you. Bye.
This podcast brought to you thanks to Tobin Brothers Funerals, celebrating lives every day of the year.